Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Michael Tolkien, whose new novel is The Return of the Player. Earlier novels include Among the Dead, The Player, Under Radar. Michael Tolkien has also written several screenplays. He's directed films. He's worked in television. Michael Tolkien, I want to talk a little about your career and how it relates to this book. But first I want to ask, why did you decide to return to the character of Griffin Mill?
It was the spring of 2002, and I was talking to a producer I know who was talking about an executive. And he said about the executive, he's Baroque. And I knew that his definition of Baroque was not according to the common definition. And it stayed with me. And then one day I was in my office. I was thinking about that executive. And then the opening sentence of the book, Griffin Mill was broke. He was down to his last $6 million, popped into my head. And 10 days later, I had 70 pages. One of the things I think that sparked it was that it was spring of 2002. We were just coming out of the first period of confusion after 9/11. I realized that one of the things that had been lost after 9/11 was the memory of the collapse of the tech bubble in March of 2001. I didn't want to write a book that was a direct reference to the bombing because it just felt that it would just be stepping into a minefield of polemics and it would be a swamp. But I could hide the collapse in Griffin's panic about the general collapse of the world and specifically about the collapse of the stock market.
Throughout the book, Griffin makes comments about the nature of Hollywood, and I got the feeling that on some level he's your mouthpiece there.
I think he represents one attribute of my experience magnified to the exclusion of everything else.
Let's talk about your career and how it relates, sure. Because in looking over all of your work, there are overarching themes, mostly about the nature of faith and meaning in a really crass and cold society, being Hollywood as it is. According to IMDb, your first work was writing an episode of Taxi. Is that correct?
A friend of mine, Mark Jacobson, had written an article for the Village Voice that was the foundation for the television series. And I think that they could have ripped him off without him ever even realizing, but they did the honorable thing and they bought the article. You know, they said, if you want to come in and pitch any stories, you can. So Mark was in L.A., and we went in and pitched an idea. I think we wrote the episode. It was heavily rewritten, but it ended up as a two-parter. And over the years, progressively, the residual checks descended to literally 3 cents.
Was that your first introduction to the horrors of Hollywood?
No, actually. My first job was as a story editor. My brother and I were working together at the time as a story editor on Delta House, which was the official spinoff series from Animal House. That was my first job. It was after a little while in Hollywood that I understood that Shakespeare didn't need to have ever been in an army or been at war or been in the court, that all of madness and all of society is enclosed within the circus of show business. Working on Delta House, the first thing I saw was that the separation between church and state and the difference between the network and the studio and the producers, and I just all fell into place. You know, it was a medieval village with its hierarchies and its guilds.
At a certain point, you began working, I think your first screenplay was Gleaming the Cube,
is that right? Gleaming the Cube.
I don't remember it too well. Is that kind of like a skateboarding movie?
It isn't kind of like a skateboarding movie. It is the skateboarding movie. The great skateboard epic. No one has touched it. In fact, there's a certain pleasure that I have. And then if I see, like, you know, I've seen skate videos being shot around L.A., and here I am, 56 years old. And I can go up to, you know, kids on skateboards who are 20 years old and say, I wrote Gleaming the Cube, and get respect.
Were you skateboarding? How did that come about?
As with all of my ideas, usually I see something that's like a little ripple in the vacuum out of which something is created. And I was driving through Orange County once at night, I guess in the days when I guess I would get stoned, and I mean, in the early 1980s when I was getting high, and I'd just drive around for a long time, also before the traffic in L.A. got so bad that you really couldn't go anywhere. And I was driving past Disneyland, and I saw this crowd of Vietnamese punks waiting to get into a club, and I was just really intrigued by that and the children of the Vietnamese boat people. And then I saw some kids on skateboards sometime after that, because the skateboard, the technology had changed, and there was a whole the renaissance in skateboards because of the new composites of the wheels. And I just started thinking about a family in which The golden child is the adopted Vietnamese boat child, and the natural-born child, who was Christian Slater, is the skate punk, and the Vietnamese boy is killed and made to look like a suicide, and Christian goes on a mission to find out why his brother killed himself and discovers it's a murder. The whole frame was really to be able to tell something about what was going on in Orange County at the time. The movie didn't quite go into some of the details that I had in the script, but I sold the script, and then I took the money from the script, and instead of buying a car, I bought about a year and worked on the player, because I had the novel was in rough form, and I finished the book because of the movie, which is how I've written all my books.
You use the day job to pay for the night job.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, well, there are several writers who do that. Jerry Stahl does that, I know. Michael Tolkien, the player made a huge splash as a film. As a book, it probably made a splash in Hollywood.
People in Hollywood don't really read that much because they don't have time and they're too nervous, but I don't think that's any different than most of the country. I don't really know how many real readers there are in the country. You know, I think if you think about, if you could say that a real reader is someone who buys 10 new novels a year, how many people are there? I mean, I can't remember the last time I was at any kind of gathering of people where four people had read the same new novel. I mean, maybe it was the corrections.
The player concerns, I think he's a producer at the time. I don't remember it that
executive.
Well.
He's never a producer. He's always been an executive.
An executive who murders a screenwriter and eventually triumphs.
Absolutely.
Very black comedy. At what point did Robert Altman get involved in making the film?
David Brown, the producer, one of the producers of Jaws and The Sting, called me one day. He had read the book, and he said, "Would you like to turn this into a movie?" I really didn't think I could, because when I wrote the book, I thought this is much too inward to be a film. But I had nothing. If I'd had something better to do at the time, I might have passed on it and let him option the book and find another writer. But what was surprising is it took me about 6 weeks to write the script. And then everybody in Hollywood said, "Well, you can't make a movie about Hollywood. It's like you can't make a baseball picture." You know, and then, of course, you know, they made Field of Dreams and the Tim Robbins movie, and Altman was given this. Altman had changed agents, I think, from one agency to another, and so William Morris, which was my agent, gave him scripts that they had, and he read it, and that was it.
Well, at that point, Altman's career had taken a nosedive, too, and he'd fought his way back by doing things like Come to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean. He had kind of lost the idea of the Altman movie with the overlapping dialogue and all that.
Well, he hadn't made a movie in Hollywood in a long time. He'd been living in Paris for a while.
Did a lot of your dialogue finally show up on screen?
Yeah. You know, the thing about an Altman movie is that there's a certain amount of invention, but, you know, a story is a piece of machinery, and you can't throw out the cogs. You still have to keep the cogs there. The writer's job is not to make sure that every single sentence is said. The writer's job is to make sure that the sense of every scene is maintained.
Were you there on the set with
him? Yeah, I was one of the producers. Otherwise, I would have been banished to, the Pine Barrens of New Jersey.
Did he allow your input on the set at all?
Sure. Yeah. The other thing is, I'd say to the degree that, you know, when you're dealing with someone who is, you know, recovers his game, what do you want, you know? It was obvious within a few days of shooting that Altman knew what he was doing. And, you know, if Altman knows what he's doing, only a fool would say, no, you know. I mean, I may have done that a couple of times, but if I did, it was stupid of me.
Well, your novels through the same time and the two films you directed, The Rapture and The New Age, deal with spiritual quests. At that particular time, were you beginning to go on yours? Had you become disillusioned with the world? Or was that just another way of talking about Orange County, you know, as you did with Gleaming the Cube, in a metaphorical sense?
If something has developed over the course of the last 20 years of working, I've become more and more interested in the way we live according to the rules of different stories, what our myths are. The big piece of The Return of the Player is that Griffin knows that Hollywood is dying, that the box office is not going to come back, and he knows it's not going to come back because the basic myths that Hollywood was making its films by, the Joseph Campbell Journey of the Hero, that no longer really works because the national myth has collapsed. Talladega Nights, which is a movie I love, is the classic Journey of the Hero, but it's a comedy because you can only really deal with the hero story now with mockery, which is a disaster for a culture, and our culture is in a disaster right now. And that's what the book is really about. And then the relationship between all of that and Griffin as a father, and how to be a father and how to take care of his three children and his wife and his ex-wife.
In that sense, then, it is a continuation of works like The Rapture and The New Age.
Right. The New Age is about marriage. The Rapture is about faith and children. This is about marriage, faith, and children.
Going back to The Rapture and New Age, The Rapture was the first. That was an independent film?
Yeah, it was an independent movie. Well, that was made by, independent. It was low budget. It was made by Fine Line, New Line. So,
Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers bought them later, but New Line was operating out of, the offices were air conditioned.
How did it feel being behind the camera?
Oh, it was great. I just finished directing something. It'll be on ABC in the spring.
That's Masters of Science Fiction.
Yeah, I directed, I adapted a Robert Heinlein's short story called Jerry Was a Man, and I just shot it with Anne Heche and Malcolm McDowell, and it's really exciting.
When you're doing that, it's a different world than writing, I would guess.
It's very exciting and very satisfying. If the script is right and the cast is right, and you're working with interesting people, it's fun. I think one of the things that gets lost, because I've just been finishing this film up in post-production, one of the things that gets lost in the world's understanding of Hollywood is that I don't think anybody has any conception of how many human hours go into polishing literally every single frame of the film, how many times each frame passes before somebody's eyes on the way to being done.
If that's the case, why are so many films just so bad?
One of the blessings of having cable TV and the Turner Classic Movies and some of the old film channels is that they have polished and restored a lot of movies from the vaults that were never seen on Million Dollar Movie when we were kids. Those of us who grew up in television in the 50s and 60s had a canon of films that was maybe 200-300 films wide, and that was it. We knew Cagney, John Ford, John Wayne, Humphrey Bogart. We knew the classic movies of the 30s and 40s. Now, they're releasing a lot of movies that were released in those days because the studios all made 50-plus movies a year, hundreds and hundreds of films, thousands of movies, and there was such crap. There was such junk in those days with big movie stars, and I think that if we had been having this conversation then, you'd say, why did Betty Davis make that stupid movie with Glenn Ford? So having sort of defended Hollywood in one direction, the other side is, the reason the movies are bad right now, and I think the movies are terrible, just horrendous, is that the story the movies used to be able to tell was the story of the hero. Family has always been the provenance of television. A movie just needs one star or two stars. A television show has to have an ensemble of people who are equally gifted and equally strong in order to work. Right now, the movies can't really deal with culture because the myth can't contain the energy of our collapsing culture. Meanwhile, if you look at Deadwood or you look at The Sopranos or even if you look at The Office and Family Guy, which are sort of the quartet of shows that I'm most interested in, they're the most interesting, I think, most interesting narrative art being done in the culture right now. I'm a huge Deadwood fan. Recommending Deadwood to somebody without having them go to the Netflix or the store and start watching it from episode one of season one is a little bit like handing somebody Great Expectations on page 300 and saying, Dickens is great, isn't he? How come you don't like the book? Dickens is great. And so you can't read Dickens from page 300. So the novel has also moved to those shows. And those shows examine the culture and really describe what's going on socially in ways that the movies are just incapable of dealing with. The movies are now a symptom.
A lot of this finds its way into Return of the Player. Would you call the Return of the Player a hero journey, too?
I think it is the story of a hero and his journey. But, what's also important in the book is that I start the book with an epigraph from Edith Wharton's A Backward Glance, one of her memoirs. She took William Dean Howells to see a production of The House of Mirth. And in The House of Mirth, the heroine dies. When she sold the rights to the play, she said the heroine has to die in the play. And they knew the play was going to fail. And Howells said to her as they were walking out, yes, what the American public always wants is a tragedy with a happy ending. So I took that as, and not just as a motto for the book, I actually took that as the source for the structure of the novel so that I could write both. I could go into the tragedy and then get to the happy ending.
Which may or may not make sense, but it doesn't matter as long as it's a happy ending.
Yes, exactly. There is a leap. There's a German phrase, Mut zur Lücke. I'm sure that's not how I pronounce it, so a German would say, what? But it means courage for the gaps, and a piano teacher I had once was talking about this in relationship to jazz. The book takes a couple of leaps, and the gaps between those leaps aren't fully filled in. So the question is, how real is the ending? That's actually the verb tense changes for the last chapter in the epilogue. I believe it. If I made the movie, it wouldn't go from color to black and white.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Tolkien, The Return of the Player. You have real people in there. You have a long conversation with Bill Clinton. Why did you do that? I mean, Clinton's a real person.
Griffin Mill comes to a point in his life where he needs to get something off his chest. All the questions in his life feel like they've been answered except one basic problem, which is how do you live with guilt and how do you move forward in the world? And the only person who can answer those questions is Bill Clinton.
Has Clinton read your book? Do you have any
I idea? Hope so. He'd be great for the part. I don't know if we ever make the movie. And the next question, I have no idea if we're going to make the movie. Right now, I'm holding that decision off.
There must have been a conscious effort then on your part, a conscious decision to combine real people and fictional characters in a way that's usually not done, particularly since Clinton is alive and well.
He's the only real person. I think he's the only real character in the book. No one else has any dialogue.
So he becomes kind of the Gandalf of the book, the mentor.
Well, right. In The Journey of the Hero, he's the mentor figure, even though he appears late.
Michael Tolkien, some of the publicity material said you recently went through an intense study of the Talmud.
I was raised in a Reform house, Reform Jewish house. And about 10, 12 years ago, my wife gave me a copy of the Art Scroll Siddur, which is an Orthodox prayer book. And I had never seen the traditional Jewish liturgy translated in full because the Reform prayer book is an abridgment. The Reform movement has since gone back towards, a lot of synagogues are going back towards traditional liturgy. And the traditional liturgy was so exciting and so rich that I had no idea that my tradition had anything that magnificent. And that led to study, and about 7, 8 years of pretty serious study.
Where do you see yourself on a spiritual path now? Are you an Orthodox?
Actually, I think I really do want to identify myself as Reform. I believe in the Reform movement. But I'm Reform with a love for the traditional liturgy. And I mean, I know the liturgy well enough now so that I can go to an Orthodox synagogue and not make a fool of myself.
Michael Tolkien, there's a quote. I think it's in the book, but it's quoted also in your other, the material I have. If it weren't for Academy screeners, no one I know would see more than 5 movies a year.
I think that was in an interview.
There are lines right. like that, right. similar to that, that Griffin Mill says, which is why he walks away from Hollywood
right.
in the book to hang out with his friend Phil Ginsberg, who is obviously not David Geffen.
There's nobody. I mean, Phil Ginsberg is stuck with $750 million and is desperate to have a billion and doesn't know how to get to his billion and is miserably unhappy about it. And the book hinges on Griffin knowing that in order for Griffin to make enough money to buy a private island in Fiji or Tonga that's high enough above the waterline so that when the ice caps melt, he'll be dry and he'll have water for crops, he's got to help Phil Ginsberg make that billion. That's the start of the novel.
Well, he walks away from Hollywood. In terms of that quote I just made, the screener's quote, and the fact that a very, very bad movie like Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, becomes one of the all-time great moneymakers, maybe the worst film to ever get to that status with no apparent reason. Is it the culture? Is it the fact that we're living in this George W. Bush wacko pundit world? What do you think is going on?
I've been reading Philip Reeve's last book, My Life Among the Death Works, which is probably the most profound thing I've read since I was reading Adorno in the Frankfurt School. It's a very dense book, so I can't just sort of state the point. But I felt like my novel, I think, was in part recognizing something in the culture. Something in the culture has been shredded from a lot of sides. And I think the thing that's been shredded is a sense of identity in relationship to something sacred. But I don't mean sacred necessarily in a supernatural way. Unfortunately, the language is the language of religion and faith, and that language has been so corrupted by people who are really pagans or barbarians using the language of faith as an instrument of violence and as an instrument of chaos. We are moving towards a culture of degradation, scourging, humiliation, invasion of privacy. And these forces are coming in part from the right and in part from the left. The central narrative that even if we didn't live by it, even if we were hypocritical, at least was something everybody understood as being at its core necessary, that narrative has been mocked to the point of weakness so that it can't hold up a culture anymore.
And that narrative is?
Reeve talks about the writing of the Declaration of Independence, and Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be sacred, that all men are created equal." And Franklin, the opportunist, changed it to self-evident. So there's a big difference. There's a huge gulf between sacred and self-evident. And self-evidence ultimately leads everything to a kind of, you know, evangelical destruction of community in favor of a personal relationship with God where community and society don't matter. In a way, that winds up sort of destroying God at the same time that it claims to be honoring God. 200 years later, you know, we've got a culture where self-esteem is the great-great-great-great-grandchild of the self-evidence of the Declaration of Independence. Things which feel like they're good or right, I think, are contributing to that disaster.
It seems almost as if the me generation and the idea of gaining self-expression from the New Age movement somehow got taken over by the right wing, and they've turned it into something maybe different and the same at the same time.
Yes, it got taken over by the right wing. The Culture of Narcissism, Christopher Lash's book, which I've also been reading, is just phenomenal to read now, 30 years after he wrote it. You know, there's a little bit of creaky Freudianism in a few places, and Reif demolishes Freud in a really brilliant way and turns Freud into a pagan, convincingly. I mean, it's difficult to talk about because we're in the midst of the collapse. And in a way, one of the reasons I think I'm a novelist instead of a philosopher, a sociologist, is that the novel for me is the form in which I can describe these processes in a way without having to sum something up, but I can allow the contradictions to float next to each other.
That's also the power of metaphor. A novel to that degree is metaphor. You're not saying something absolutely.
Right.
You're also exploring rather than coming up with answers.
As William Carlos Williams wrote, the poem is a capsule wherein we wrap up our punishable secrets. And that's also something that you can do in a book.
Michael Tolkien, you did two other screenplays, and I'd like you to relate them to what we've been talking about here. One is Deep Impact, which was about a meteor hitting the Earth. The other, Changing Lanes.
Yeah. I shared credit on both of those films. I think in both of them, particularly with Deep Impact, I wanted to make it about if the world was really given a few weeks' notice to survive, how would people react emotionally? What would be generous and how would people behave generously and how people would behave selfishly?
And Changing Lanes?
I guess I just got really interested in the question of someone who believes that if he could just do one more bad thing, then after that he'll be good. That notion that if you just, all right, I know this is bad, but after that I promise I'll be good. And what happens when you make that kind of bargain with yourself? Griffin, in a way, is the same character. You know, if I just kill one more person, then I can get out of here.
Michael Tolkien, where do you see yourself going from here after writing this? You've got this Jerry Was a Man that you've worked on. Are you working on other sequences?
Yeah, I've been adapting. I'm about 4 hours away from finishing, after a year and some months, an adaptation of The Martian Chronicles for Universal. It's been a very, very difficult script because Bradbury does not lend himself to the movies as easily as, say, Philip K. Dick does. You know, even if Philip K. Dick gets ripped off or misappropriated, there's something about his vision which has certainly worked for a while. And we're trying to take Bradbury and take his 1950s, very negative, it's a very grim book.
But it's also more short stories.
What we've done there is we basically few stories from the incidents in the book, which take place over a long time, and wove them together into one narrative.
Did you go back and look at that television?
No, I didn't.
Dick also, I think, lends himself to the fact of a culture collapsing, which I think is one of the reasons so many Philip K. Dick books have been made into films.
Right. I mean, his is a very sexy dystopia. And also, what's interesting in Dick is that, and Scanner Darkly as a novel certainly caught our really split, our multiple selves. I don't want to say split identity because that just means two, but the way our identities have shattered so that we have no identity. And that is also, again, it comes back to, you know, this sort of collapsing central story against which we can elevate ourselves.
Well, when you put it in a context, in a broader context, then almost the election or non-election of George W. Bush becomes irrelevant, except maybe furthering the process along faster.
Yeah, you know, Bush is a monster, but I think he's also an expression of a process. It's interesting that given a fake cowboy and a real cowboy, the country tends to prefer the fake.
You know, print the legend.
Yeah. That's The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. The whole movie is a flashback as Jimmy Stewart comes into town to bury John Wayne. The story is about how Jimmy Stewart became a senator because he shot Liberty Valance, but the thing that destroys John Wayne is that Liberty Valance, Lee Marvin, has the drop on Jimmy Stewart. Wayne, in the shadows, shoots Lee Marvin as Jimmy Stewart is shooting at him. Stewart misses. Wayne gets Lee Marvin, and then Stewart becomes the hero. But Wayne, having violated his own code, winds up becoming the town drunk and then dies disconsolate. The whole story is being narrated. He narrates the whole story. This boy journalist, the Jimmy Olsen of the story, says, "I'm going to write that down." And the newspaper editor says, "No, you're not going to do anything like that. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend." Philip Reeve, in the new book, talks about watching Reverend Ralph Abernathy on the Today Show with Bryant Gumbel. And Abernathy had written a book in which he talked about Martin Luther King's sex life and his womanizing. And Gumbel said, "Why did you put that in there?" And Abernathy said, "Well, because it's true. You can't know the whole story without it." And Gumbel said, "Well, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend." But what Gumbel doesn't understand is that in the movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, you see the whole story. You are not excluded from the legend. So you get it. So you know what's behind it. But if you just follow that as an ethic and you don't tell the whole story, then you're committing a lie.
Sitting here talking to writers, one thing I do find is there seems to be common threads in virtually every writer I speak to, virtually every person, and it seems to be running counter to what we see in the mainstream media.
To me, the mainstream media, I was in the airport this morning, the mainstream media is watching Clay Aiken on the Today Show on a plasma screen in the waiting room at the Burbank Airport. That's the mainstream media.
When you see people in Hollywood, creative people, does that give you any hope? Are there good? There are good creative people in Hollywood.
I don't think there's a lot of really great art made at any one time. And I think the drama is the weakest of all art forms. The entire period of Greek drama that we pay attention to.
50 years.
Between Greek drama and Shakespeare, there's a little bit of Roman stuff, but there's not, it's not part of the canon. There's, every man does not play at the Stratford Festival. And then you get Shakespeare. And then after Shakespeare, you get some Molière, you get a little bit of Racine, maybe, some of the Germans, some Italians who aren't global but have some local relevance. And then you get to the 20th century. And that's all of drama. That's it. And I think that film, the movies, like the golden ages of theater, had their 70, 80 years.
Michael Tolkien, are you beginning to think about another novel now?
Yeah, but I don't have unused novels in the file cabinet, and so I'd like to write one faster than I got to this one after Under Radar, but I've got a couple of ideas that are glimmering around.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Tolkien, whose latest novel is The Return of the Player. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.